pleroma. In preaching to the Gnostics of his day, Paul was using one of their own favorite words. They used to like to sling that word pleroma around, meaning fullness. Pleroma. He's just full of education. He's a pleroma scholar. He's a full scholar. All right, y'all want to play with that? I'll give you a pleroma. The Gnostics were preaching fullness of deity, and that the fullness of deity had hundreds of manifestations in hundreds of ways. That's what they were preaching. Gnostics said that deity was manifested in all of nature, and that nature alone was the sum total of deity. So Paul here had to take their favorite word and preach that fullness was not in anything you could chop down. Fullness could not be in anything that you can run along.
Blue railroad train and going down the railroad track. It makes me feel so doggone blue to listen to that old smokestack. Drivers are rolling on, leaving me here behind. Give me back them good old days and let me ramble down the line. Blue railroad train, leaving me here alone. You're treating me good, bad and making me think of home. I hear that lonesome train, I love to hear the whistle blow. She's taking the sun and leaving the rain and making me want to go. Got the blues, longing for her company. It's many miles from where I am to the only one for me. It's so lonesome here, waiting for the manifest. I hope that engineer is kind enough to let me be his guest.
Dave Monk, Gabriel Monk, WEFT, Champagne 90.1 on your FM dial.
And Dave on the board. This is Sunday, January the 13th, 2019. And this is the Prairie Monk program, WEFT's weekly look at all things environmental, conservational, rails, trails, and greenways.
Well, we have a lot of snow out there. It's warmer than I thought it would be. Less snow than I thought it would be. But my building started to get colder and colder and colder. So I went downstairs to have a look at the boiler, and there was a stream of water coming out of the inspection glass. And I turned the heater right down low so it wouldn't be involved, and called up plumbers. And late in the night that we decided that it probably wasn't dangerous. Could last till the morning. So in the morning, I had a plumber come. And I want to remind people that this is a season when machinery kicks in for the first time. We've had very warm weather. And you might want to just be up to date with your maintenance. And make sure that your equipment is working. You don't notice it for a while because your building is warm from warm weather. And so this is a fairly infrequent event. And People were taking notice. They were stocking up with food and things like that just to make sure that they didn't have to run on roads that are slippery and wet. It's kind of nice snow. It's light, heavy, and probably is a good snow for making snowmen. But inside, we're having a few problems. And it reminded me that the technological industry, the people who service a lot of the equipment that we have, is facing a reasonable shortage of people. And there's a reason why. We try to figure out why, but let me deal with the situation that I had first, so that you know how this sort of service industry ties in. Well, first of all, the public needs to know a little bit about their machinery. That means that the plumber who comes is very helpful in explaining what they're doing. In this case, there was no good reason why the glass inspection unit broke. It's a reasonably new boiler. It's probably 10 years old, but that's reasonably new for a boiler. And so I had been putting washers in faucets. Mm-hmm. And in order to do that, you have to turn the water off. When you turn the water back on, it has to replace the air that occupies the water system that drained in order for you to work with a tap. So I wondered if that had anything to do with the glass, and then apparently not. So we're faced with the fact that if you were out of town for 3 days, that could be a mess. There was water all over the basement floor. A thin strip of about a pen-sized stream of water coming out, and that can add to a financial situation too, because if you have that much water going, you can very shortly use up 1,000 gallons of water. So it was explained to me that the inspection glass was for a convenience so that you could see the water level quickly, but it could quite easily be bypassed, and that was what was organized. And the pilot light had gone out probably because of excess of moisture around. And that had to be relit, and after the bypass was cut off, there was still a little steam coming out of there, and we had to wait for the boiler to heat its water to the point where it produced steam, and some of that steam was leaking out of the inspection area that was tightened up. And we had heat back. We had to go and to check the ranges in the building just to see that it was working. And you have to go back and check it several times to make sure things are working. And I was very pleased that we could have someone come on Saturday morning and work that over. And during the week, we'll get a replacement glass for the inspection area. And there's probably another meter that needs to be replaced. The boiler doesn't exactly run on its own. If you come from a climate as I do that's warm, we don't have boilers. If you come from South Carolina, you probably don't have boilers to deal with either. But if you're in the colder areas, you need to take that boiler's water. It accumulates rust and junk over the season. You need to drain that and see that the water is reasonably pure. It just needs to have someone around who can check these things out. I can remember the days when fraternities would leave town and unfortunately a broken window would allow cold into a building and the pipes would freeze, and that can be a horrendous replacement cost. So it behooves us to either be around or have someone around who can check these things out intermittently to see that they don't get out of hand. So now let me look at the training of these people overall. At the moment we have a lot of degreed people, some of them quite efficient robotry people who can do some of these jobs automatically. You can have a robot that can take service people out of action in some cases. This has always been an industrial problem, whether it was in the Middle Ages or since. You always are inventing something that will eliminate jobs. Even the invention of an axe would take somebody to invent it, and then somebody else will lose the job of breaking the twig of the tree that would use an axe to chop it. So we're always faced with innovation that will take people out of action. So we also have prominence of the recognition that degrees are respectable and give people a general education as well as a specific education. But right now we tend to have more degreed people than there are jobs for those degreed people. If you're a robotics person, then you need to work with a company that needs robotics industry. So how do we balance this out? You do need service people. It might be a situation where it's a hurry up and wait situation. If you have a train that has to be driven, it has to be parked on a siding, or it has to cover traffic at bridges and things like that. So it requires people who are often younger and with instant responses that can handle a situation that is not anticipated. So there's a level of awareness here that's rather important. It's also very rewarding when the service person is able to save a building or save a train crash. What do we do with this population of people? One of the things that was beautiful about the U.S. has been the establishment of colleges called Cal Colleges that came to the country about the time of the Civil War and after, that allowed people to get an education, and it was a very practical education. It told you how to put in drains to drain the field and eliminate the water and that drainage was necessary to create agriculture. So agriculture and engineering and general schooling was a main aim of these colleges. And gradually, those colleges become major universities, and they still have an extension responsibility. David has just been going to a master gardener, part of the College of Agriculture.
Master Naturalist, please.
Master Naturalist. And so this is giving the public a chance to be educated, but it's also allowing stewards to be educated and service people to be educated. And there's a need for people to be docents, to become knowledgeable and then transmit that knowledge to other people. So community colleges came then, and fairly much into the 60s and 70s, 80s, and we have one called Parkland College, which does very well at this sort of game. And it often has teachers who are oriented to teaching rather than oriented to research. We need the research. We need the prairie institutes that will allow people to know more about their landscape and their engineering and things like that. The community colleges have therefore done fairly well. They cost the state. States usually have to put in money to keep those colleges going, and the state has done fairly well with different administrations keeping that sort of college in action. We also are fortunate that we get to be somewhat broadly educated. So that college not only educates the specialists that are the service people, but it also educates the general public. One of my aims when coming to the University of Illinois was to combine media and art and science and education. There's a tendency for the major universities to become very important research organizations to make discoveries, and that's slightly administratively different from the applied side, the extension side of those universities. And I had the same sort of experience in Australia. The University of Sydney is fairly fundamentally research-oriented. That's not totally true, but rough generalization is true. The University of New South Wales is somewhat more applied. The University of New South Wales took over from organizations that were like sort of areas where you worked during the day and you studied at night. And it got to be that those people were very, very popular as employees because they experienced during the day and learned during the night. But that it was so much information and so much night work that many of the people who belonged to those programs didn't really get there because it was so invasive. So the University of New South Wales sort of replaced a lot of those small institutions that were specialized in music or engineering or art or surveying or whatever it was that they checked out on. And also the second level university would give you an education. My brother was a civil engineer, and it was very helpful to have more than just an engineering background, but to understand the landscape that he was going to work with for life. And there is, however, a fair gap between those higher-level institutions and colleges. I was at an agricultural college, and I felt that the difference between studying fundamental biochemistry at the university level and the applied use of rules of thumb were a little hard on people's minds who would want to do a little bit more to understand what the rule of thumb was about. So one of the reasons why I came here was to look at media and other things to try and bridge that gap. I was coming into an RNA, DNA era, and that is not easy to understand for people who are at community college level. But fortunately, we have a bunch of people who are often very well oriented to teaching. And so sometimes the chemistry courses, the physics courses, the mathematics courses, the sociological courses, the biology, are taught by people who have a community orientation. And that's been rather wonderful. So we have to be rather proud of the fact that we have a community college nearby, which often is a resource for teaching people subjects that would be more respected at the university level, but it's assumed you understand and know, and we don't always do that. We don't always have that level of sophistication and or that degree of brilliance either. Not everyone is a Nobel Prize winning student. There's a lot of people who have a real ability, but it's not going to be genius level. So that sort of balance is across the state. We have Jim Ayers, who has been president at Parkland College for many years, often president of the board, but also very much involved in other community colleges across the state and also across the country. And so we have to be fairly proud of that sort of organization that educates people who are often having a lot of fun doing these things. There is a reward to someone coming to fix your boiler and actually seeing that it works. He knows enough to do that. But he also was saying he studied photography at Parkland College, and now it's totally obsolete, the hypo that he was using, the darkroom he was using, is now changed. So we have to have people who are prepared to face that change. He's no longer quite so excited by photography. He may use it to record numbers on the equipment he's looking at, but now everyone can do their own photography, and you have to be somewhat exceptional to be out there with material that people would enjoy picking up because they don't do it themselves, but most everyone can pick up a cell phone and take photographs. So the whole internet thing has changed. So how do we educate the public in general? Firstly, the commercial people who are in control of the industry, say it's the plumbing industry or the construction industry, they have to be aware that of these changes, and they often do take serious advantage of them. The internet and things like that. If I go to a garage anymore, somebody speaks into a phone and gets a tutorial for this particular piece of equipment and knows what the parts are needed. And wow, that information is right there. How do we talk to the owners of the service industries to encourage their participants to have this sort of general interest and be able to themselves as the service people to have a general education and an understanding of how this piece of equipment fits into an overall thing. It was in the past very possible for a company to be belong to one family, and all the members of the family kept doing the same thing. Nowadays, there's a lot of different input from different directions, and how do you handle that? And then you also need people in the public who know enough about their modern technology to be able to use it effectively. It's like a learning curve for everything that you do. So in that whole process, I want to encourage people to not necessarily feel that they have to have a degree for a rewarding life. It just might be that if you were a service person, you can be well-educated and well-rounded, but also very effective as a citizen. And so we think about those things. And I encourage the extension services to get out there that teach farmers how to fertilize, how to herbicide and pesticide without overdoing it and getting modified genetics and whatnot, and sort of getting invaded invading the next door field with herbicides and chemicals that are blowing around. So we have to balance the technology with how we use it and how we prevent water going into the places like the Mississippi and down into the Gulf and destroying the organisms there. Yeah. I think that's enough to say something about your technology, but be careful. Be aware that your roof is not leaking, that your house is not going to blow over. That there are technologies that you can use. Not always do those technologies get out into the boondocks. So we have in rural Illinois lots of places that don't have the same internet opportunity that you have in the city. So there's a tendency for young folk especially to move into a city situation where they have the internet, where they have friends and relatives who with whom they can share their poetry and their visual material or sing and dance with more and others. It's sometimes very surprising for students that come from a very rural school to also encounter a large university in a relatively large town where they're a very small person in a big fish pool, whereas in their hometown they may have been a big fish in a small pool. So we have to think about those sorts of things, and some of it runs to feelings and almost the spirituality of how you preserve a tree or a grass or a daisy or how you run a railroad wheel on a steel line. How does that? How do you handle energy. So we're very dependent on all these levels of education and opportunity and reward. And sometimes the reward is not there. Now, many of the people that we have informally teach, they teach others about what they have and what they know, and don't always get paid very much for that. There's also a lingering problem that if you share your technology, you might just be losing your opportunity to make money. So there's sometimes a copyright on what you're doing and thinking. So it gets to be a problem of not sharing your information generally. But that has gotten much better. We have copyright laws that are still going through machinations, but often those laws allow materials that would otherwise be stopped up by the law. They are held in law, not available to people for many years, perhaps even the best part of a century. And those ideas and discussions and political interactions and the poetry and the drama are locked up for many years. So the talent for people who are copyright specialists is to not to preserve the right of the person who has developed the idea, but to not make it so stringent that the idea can't be utilized for many, many years. We hope that sort of thing doesn't get in the way of general teaching, and it sometimes does, but the people who administer these things are kind, and they try to make sure that the general public has access to ideas that would otherwise be tied up. I think that's probably enough to say that it's important to have various levels of education and opportunity, and there's also a need for everything not to be 9 to 5. Some of the most innovative ideas come from agencies that actually allow one day a week for free thinking or just relaxation and education. And there's also a need for some degree of relaxation. I get a lot of action or reaction from people who go to other countries and find that they are a little more laid back, and sometimes that laid back nature can be very heartening and generous in people's interactions. So, when those people are not there, you miss them. I this week called the Surface Transportation Board, forgetting that the Surface Transportation Board is not in action at the moment. And so I had a question about the width of rail trails, and I have to wait till the stalemate between the government and the president to be able to interact in the manner that I'm talking about. So not always straightforward, but very experimental. You have to be prepared to be a politician sometimes and to take these ideas into action. And just sitting in the background doesn't always help. So this week we had a report from the about the aquifer. It was it's been probably many years since we've known that we have a wonderful aquifer that starts in east of Urbana, east of Champaign County, runs through to Beardstown and into the Illinois River. It provides us with some of the best water in the world, even much better than we get in a bottled water, but the bottled water is convenient. The water underneath us is pure, as long as it doesn't get contaminated. Well, in the last few years, we had a lot of discussion about the Mahomet Aquifer, and it was had a landfill on top of it at Clinton that was taking or potentially taking PPCs from other states, and those chemicals were likely to leach into the aquifer. There was a lot of debate about this. This aquifer has pure water, so towns on either side, like if you're on the aquifer, sitting on top of it, you may be able to put a well into the aquifer directly. But David and I went to a meeting in Weldon not too long ago, and there was a discussion about wells being taken up, drying up, because Decatur from the south was utilizing the water, and they were outside the aquifer, but they were taking water to get there. There are wells at Monticello that feed into the Sangamon River that didn't take that water down to Decatur. And so there are like 500,000, a lot of people who use this water. It might be more like, it's probably 500,000 is not a untoward figure. There are communities on either side of this aquifer that take the water. We don't know exactly what the water, the perched water tables, the various parts of this aquifer are like. So there's been a task force, and that task force has been a cooperative of five different mayors from different towns, Monticello, Decatur, Clinton, Champaign-Urbana, and this task force was led by Chapin Rose, who's senator at the state level, and they've come up with a report, and it's asking for $20 million to map the aquifer so that you know if there is a perched water table and where it is and how high is it and how can it be drained and how can it be susceptible to contamination if you're going to drink water from that aquifer. There's also a need to know where this water comes from. How is it taken in? Is this water 1,000 years old, or does this aquifer replenish? So they're asking that the Prairie Institute, which used to be the Natural History Survey, be given money to map and set up some paradigms associated with the Mahomet Aquifer. We know that it goes west and gets to be higher at near the river, and the Illinois River. We know that the beds there are more likely to intake quickly than beds that are in the east. We know that there's a huge amount of irrigation coming out of that aquifer, and it's even the agricultural use exceeds the use of water by the Twin Cities of Champaign and Urbana. So how do we look at this? Underneath the aquifer, there are anticyclones and synclines that are part of the underlying geology. And those areas are able to take gas and store gas from the south on its way to places like Chicago. And sometimes they leak, and they leak into the aquifer. So we need to know more about that that system. And recently there's been a situation where some water wells will almost catch on fire because there is enough gas coming out of that well. So we need surveillance. We need some control over the industry that's injecting the gas into those synclines and anticlines. And we need to know more about the geology of the beds that contain this gas. Are they shales or slates or sandstones or what have you? The Illinois used to be under an ocean, so some of our material there is very much lacustrine or has been under the sea for some time. When it's buckled up and moved, are there fault lines that could allow for a release of gases? So these are all things that we need to look to, and we also need the general public to know more about this. The aquifer for a long time has been a mystery, but in the last 10 years it's been watched fairly carefully, and there's been a lot of concern about its possible contamination. If you are doing coal and you finish washing your coal and you want to get rid of your coal, there's a temptation to put it into the ground, and where does that leachate go, and is it dangerous, and is it contaminating the whole of that aquifer? So the request for the state to put $20 million into this research and into providing people who will surveil the use of the ground underneath the aquifer, how do we move gases across the aquifer if we're going to Chicago or from Texas or what have you. We need to know more, and I think this is a very genuine effort to give the public a better knowledge of their resources and to ask questions as to how it might be controlled. There are no easy answers, and this group is very prepared to say that they don't know all the answers. What they're proposing right now is a step in the right direction, but there will always be new opportunities for consideration. One of them, essentially, is do we take this very ancient water and use it to irrigate corn and soybeans. It makes money for corn and soybeans, and for farmers. But is that an excessive use of water that is very pure? I think you need to know who is doing this. I think even the mayors that are involved have been very pleased to be a part of this task force and to understand more about their landscape. It looks like we have a flat landscape, but it's not exactly simple to understand. And some research and education is very, very helpful. Let me see.
15 minutes.
I put some notes down here. Yeah. So if you're a citizen in this area, you should know more about your water, your landscape, your glaciation, your history that's there, and how we might preserve it. And David said something about construction and the loss of vegetation. And you may have a comment to make on that.
Not this week. I'm sorry. When did I say that? Sorry.
Okay. I think I'll pick up on it. One of the things that Smile politely said recently, they were discussing the loss of Pocket Prairie, and they classed it as the worst experience in Champagne recently. It's understandable. We have occupied a piece of real estate that's not been used otherwise for many years. It was there for billboards, and the billboards were considered to be too large for proximity to a federal highway, so they had to be grandfathered out and replaced with a smaller billboard. But that small retreat that was there for 30 years with small trees and a trail through the prairie was intended to allow people to get an idea of what a prairie forest ecosystem was. We had at one stage about 50 different species there. They could sort themselves out. The shade species would be in the shade, and those species that were edge timber would find their place there, or we would put them in there in the first place, knowing what their requirements were. And then the open areas with lots of sunlight would contain most of the prairie species, and that little trail around it was very educationally appropriate for scientific education. But it also was ambiance. It was also a place where people could retreat and enjoy to read a book. As we get more and more apartments in the city, then we tend to take out these little pieces of real estate that were awkward to deal with and were therefore left alone, but now are utilized for buildings. Do we keep doing development without little enclaves of nature and nurture and other things too? We used to have a lot of theaters, and even movie theaters. Now you get that on the internet. But there's something about having an EBIT first. There's something about having the opportunity to have historic trains come to Champaign. It's not simple. We have we own 4 miles of railroad bed between Whiteheath and Seymour, and we're in the process of re-railing that so that we could hopefully get historic trains from Monticello Railroad Museum into Champaign. Then there's a question of where that sort of equipment should park. The railroad that used to go from Champaign to Whiteheath to Monticello to Cisco to Oriana to Decatur and then up to Clinton and back with from Lane to Weldon to DeLand to Whiteheath and then back into Champaign. That sort of local train was taken out. But the Railroad Museum retained 7 miles of active bed. So then they had not only the interurban railroad bed, which they restored and were using for public opportunity, but now they had a main line that they could put steam engines on and utilize. They mainly utilized 3 miles of it. But in the long run, we hope that they will be able to utilize up to Whiteheath and then join our 4 miles and come into Champaign. If you understand the system, the railroad has not totally been eliminated. It's decapitated, and at the moment it is active to I-57, which is a highway, and it stops about what used to be called Staley. Staley was a little center and an elevator just on the west side of Champaign. Once you get there, then with your historic train, you have to know that you're hoping to get into Champaign, but you would have to use Canadian National Railroad. How do you do that negotiation? If you're on somebody else's railroad, then you usually have to pay for a pilot to drive your train for the area where you're on somebody else's rail. This involves negotiation with the Surface Transportation Board, the railroads concerned, and the people who do that sort of work. We have thought that we might be able to get as far as State Street, where there used to be ice factory where you could store ice over winter and sell it. That factory has been torn down now and may become part of a drainage situation. But the railroad that we're talking about used to come into that area and then go through on what was called a Wabash railroad. And that allowed the rail to go through across the Canadian National Railroad, which used to be the Illinois Central. And then it ran into Banner and went down to Sydney. And that was a parallel line to a Big Four line that came through from Danville to St. Joe to Champaign-Urbana, and then cut off and went towards Bloomington. So now there was a recent derailment on the old Wabash line, and there was an agreement between Canadian National and Norfolk Southern, which owns the railroad that goes to Bloomington. The track that comes in from Monticello now goes over onto Norfolk Southern and gets into the Canadian National Railroad situation. That leaves a stub of old railroad we think might be a possible site for a historic train and a bicycle way, perhaps, that comes in from Havana, perhaps even on the old Wabash line. All these things take negotiation. It may take 20 years to work. It may be that we only get to start with the 4 miles to Seymour because we own it. It may be that we can work with Canadian National, the two elevators concerned. Bonneville and Seymour have sort of retired from the railroad field because they are small elevators and the rental is fairly high, and the mainline railroads would prefer to work with elevators that have a lot of grain, so they can pick up 125 cars at once or 200 cars in some cases and move commodities fairly easily. So that grain at Bonneville and Seymour has gone on the road. Could we convince that those railroads to come back to the railroad and utilize that 7 miles between Seymour and Staley, Seymour, Bonneville, Staley? That involves the Surface Transportation Board at the federal level, which controls railroading. That also involves Canadian National. How do we talk to that? If it has any involvement with vegetation on either side or trails on an adjacent interurban, that's another whole question. Some of the interurban line has been consumed. That's a term for having been utilized, and it's in farmland. So it's not easy to do this sort of thing. And you have to have a public that understands what the advantages are. Since there's been a Rail Banking Act where railroaders use bicycle trails and hiking trails and vegetation trails to preserve the dignity of a railroad bed, there has been money for reinstituting the right-of-way or preserving the right-of-way. And that money is designed to preserve the corridor, knowing that if a railroad wanted to come back in 100 years' time, that they would not be able to buy an equivalent right-of-way. And if they did have the opportunity to buy it, there would be a lot of public opposition. Okay. So just thinking about those things, keep it in mind. Talk. I go to city meetings, and in this case, I have to say, excuse me, but I want you to think outside the box. I want you to think outside your jurisdiction and think about where your people recreate, where they like to live, and if this particular train would be a help in any way, and how can it interact with bicycle ways and internet things. And we think about the same is happening with a line to Bloomington and the fact that some of that is being abandoned at the present time. So we're at the end of the day. Thanks for listening. This is Dave Monk, your Prairie Monk, WAFT Champagne 90.1 on your FM dial.
And Dave on the board. As always, the views and opinions expressed are solely those of the speakers and no one else. It is now noon. It's time for Shruti, Music of India, here on WEFT Champagne 90.1 FM. We are community radio for East Central Illinois.